For the past few years, Morning Edition has gone noir in August, profiling crime novelists and the places they write about. Our series, Crime in the City, resumes this morning in an unlikely locale, Brattleboro, Vermont. It's one of America's best small arts towns, highlighted with white church steeples. NPR's Netta Ulaby went there to talk to mystery writer Archer Mayer, who, as it turns out, is an unlikely character as well.
Archer Mayer and I are tooling around downtown Brattleboro in his pickup truck, and he's telling stories about his jobs working as a death examiner for the state's medical office and investigating child sex crimes for the local sheriff's department. He's also been filling me in about his super classy New England blue blood family.
Your background seems pretty atypical for a cop.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I've met too many people like me.
Archer Mayer's uncle ran the Metropolitan Museum of Art. His aunt was a famous sculptress. Another relative helped start the Woods Hole Oceanic Institute in Massachusetts. His big sister married Senator Fulbright. That's the kind of family we're talking about.
My paternal side of my family comes from the old New England lunatic fringe. They're filled with scientists and poets and writers and painters and musicians.
Archer Mayer's written almost 25 mysteries about Vermont police detective Joe Gunther. He never physically describes him, but fans tend to think he looks a lot like Archer Mayer. Lean, rangy, crinkly-eyed, kind of an older version of Alan Alda's character from MASH, Hawkeye. For his creator, Joe Gunther is like a best friend.
He's probably the most decent man one could conceive. Not only is he avuncular and thoughtful and supportive and caring, etc., etc., etc.,
he's also imperfect. Joe Gunther is unable to maintain a relationship, though he's friends with all his exes, and he works well with oddballs and misfits. Mayer says this detective fits in a town both working class and a little airy-fairy, with a strong hippie and weekender contingent. Here's a reading from his book, The Surrogate Thief.
Ask anyone in the country about Vermont, and you are almost sure to be given some impression, however inaccurate. From the Green Mountain Boys to maple syrup, skiing, fall foliage, and cows, not to mention civil unions, and some surprisingly high-profile, plain-speaking politicians. Vermont tends to stick in people's minds, if not always benignly. It is a place with a resonance beyond its modest statistics, and for Joe, a world in itself.
The Surrogate Thief is actually about an old murder resurfacing amidst the bloodsport of state politics. His mysteries delve into Canadian smuggling rings, pedophilia, extreme environmental activism, and, because this is Vermont, shenanigans at ski resorts. They're some of the most popular books in Brattleboro, according to the director of the local library, Jerry Carboni.
One-fifth of all of our circulation in the top 100 are his.
Archer Mayer's definitely a local celebrity. People yell at him for autographs while we're walking down the street. One of the problems with setting mysteries in this quaint red brick Victorian town is that it's actually so nice here, Mayer says.
Brattleboro and Vermont in general is such an inordinately pleasant place. I'll take you to a bad part of town and you will be astonished at how pleasant it looks.
We rattle past an old parlor organ factory, a row of somber slate buildings, and some mildly dilapidated rooming houses. Mayer calls one of them the Misery Hilton. It appeared in his book Gatekeeper, about a surge in Vermont's heroin traffic. Then, an advance up a hill into a crumbling old cemetery.
I'll give you a bird's eye view of what the dead can see, if only they could.
These leafy green grounds were a site of a secret midnight meeting that went terribly wrong.
But in fact, in real police work, there have also been encounters and observances done here. People do illicit things in graveyards for obvious reasons. They're off the beaten path. A lot of people find them creepy and therefore don't visit them much. So if you want to do an illicit transaction of one nature or another, you might well do it at a cemetery.
This one has gothic atmosphere to burn.
It has a spectacular view of a mountain right across the Connecticut River from Brattleboro. And it is a sylvan heaven. It is just gorgeous.
Archer Mayer bumps us back down to town to one of Brattleboro's meanest streets.
So this is Arch Street, which is really not a street at all, but a crumbling mess of debris and compacted soil alongside and parallel to a curve of the railroad that runs through the backside of Brattleboro.
There's broken windows, graffiti, maybe even a crumpled up Ben and Jerry's ice cream wrapper on the ground. This is Vermont-style gritty. And there was an Archer Mayer murder here, a homeless man found on the train tracks.
It looks perhaps like a suicide because he's rested his head on the tracks.
That's from the mystery book Occam's Razor. But the passing train also obliterated the man's hands and, conveniently, his fingerprints.
And so for our well-attuned and observant Joe Gunther, he thinks to himself, no, when you commit suicide, you don't put your hands. Funnily enough, you're more protective of your hands.
Stories like that one are never, ever drawn from real police work, Mayer says. He draws a clear ethical boundary between his writing and his jobs in law enforcement. At the police station, when he introduces me to his colleague, Detective Lieutenant Mike Carrier, I asked what he thought of Mayer's books.
Actually, I don't read his books. I mean, I'll wait for the movies, and as you can see, he doesn't have any movies out, so it's going to be a while.
I know. God kills me.
Are you curious?
No.
See, that's the secret of our success as a team.
It's apparently not unusual for cops to avoid mystery novels. Archer Mayer actually does not read them either.
Murder is just something that we do to each other all the time. Every day, there's going to be a headline somewhere with a murder in it. Unfortunately, it's a way that we human beings express ourselves. However poorly, I might add.
Even in beautiful Vermont, Archer Mayer finds shadows among the lush low mountains and pretty little towns, and his detective, Joe Gunther, finds a way to beat them back. To beat them back. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Esquire magazine once called George Pelecanos the poet laureate of the D.C. crime world. That's Washington, D.C., of course. Pelecanos has written 17 novels, all of them set in the nation's capital. He also wrote for the TV series The Wire, set in Baltimore, now writes for the New Orleans show Tremé, but the District of Columbia is home for him. And for our series Crime in the City, about crime novelists and their haunts, NPR's Elizabeth Blair cruised the streets of D.C. with the author. A note here to listeners, this story is going to contain some offensive language.
When George Pelecanos writes about crime in D.C., he's also writing about race and class. He says it all started when he was 11 years old. He was working at his dad's coffee shop downtown. To get there, he'd take the bus from his home in a Maryland suburb. It was the summer of 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. had recently been assassinated, and there'd been rioting in the streets.
I was on the bus going down 7th Street, which had just burned down two months earlier, and then, you know, seeing the people on the bus, they were acting differently than they had before. They were dressing much more boldly, and I remember the women wearing these big earrings, said black is beautiful on them, and they had silhouettes of women with afros. And then I'd get to work, and the counter was there, and my dad and I, Greek Americans, and an all-black crew on one side of the counter, and on the other side was white professionals, because it was 1968. And, you know, the counter was a dividing line. I knew it. And I've been writing about race and class my whole career. I mean, that's where it all comes from. It comes from that summer, pretty much.
D.C. was a powder keg back then, says Pelecanos, with the tension between the white police and the black residents. That's partly why he made one of his most important characters, Derek Strange, one of D.C.'s first black cops. In one scene, a black crowd gathers in front of a drugstore in a blighted part of the city. They're throwing rocks and bottles. Derek Strange and his white partner were called to the scene.
Strange and Troy joined the police line in front of the store and spread out several arm lengths, but remained side by side.
This is from the audiobook of the novel Hard Revolution.
From what Strange could see, he was the sole black officer on the scene. He heard screams of Tom and House Nigger and felt a pounding in his head. He brandished his stick and slapped it rhythmically into his palm. He did not look the crowd members in their eyes. Serve and protect. Do your job.
There were also white cops who didn't like blacks being hired. For his research, Pelecanos interviewed former D.C. police officers. One told him some white officers out and out quit.
They weren't going to work with black officers. These are guys that he said he didn't even know they were like that, but they just when it started happening, they said, I'm done. You know, this isn't going to work for me.
The street crimes of a George Pelicanos novel can be brutal. And oftentimes, there's more than one unfolding in the same book. Neighborhood murders, drug lords, prostitutes, hate crimes. Even the good guys get ugly.
I'm not really interested in writing books about racists. I think much more interesting is people that don't think that they have any kind of those bad feelings inside of them and they deny it.
Pelicanos makes all of them vivid. He tells you what car they drive and what music they listen to. With the greasers, it might be Springsteen or a rocker named Link Wray. With Detective Derek Strange, it's the soundtracks to westerns and classic soul.
Oh, I look like I'm down in my luck.
Derek Strange was a star athlete in high school. He's a leader in his community. Later, he coaches Pee Wee football. When he becomes a private investigator, he opens his office in the neighborhood where he grew up so that kids can see a strong black man going to work every day.
Yeah, I'm going to take you by his house.
Yeah. Okay. These row houses look like they've been around for a while.
Yeah, this is real old Washington here.
Fictional Strange would have lived here when he was a boy with his mom and dad and brother. Families live here, but crime is high.
When I first started writing about this neighborhood, there was, you know, they would find dead bodies here in the morning. Kids would be walking to school and there'd be a dead body stashed here.
There are some strong parallels between real life and Pelicanos' fiction, says D.C. homicide detective Mitch Cradle.
All of our murders that we deal with are normally in the neighborhoods.
Detective Cradle has worked for D.C. police for 25 years. He says when Pelicanos writes the good guys and the bad guys in the same community, that's the real thing.
A lot of the criminal element is not necessarily from outside of those communities. For us as detectives, it's not hard for us to gather information in those communities because everyone knows who's committing them, opposed to being strangers. So I can see where George can really get a feel for what he's writing about because any and everything he needs is right there.
George Pelicanos does the kind of shoe leather work of a detective when he's working on a novel, walking the streets, talking to people, studying the history of a neighborhood. As we drive through D.C. together, he points out landmarks that he includes in his books. For his new novel, The Cut, he picked out exactly which house his protagonist, Spiro Lucas, would rob.
Because I cased it. I went back in the alley and I looked to see if you could break into a place in the middle of the day. And, I mean, I can even show you the house. And so all these things...
Did you bring your tools, too?
Yeah, the tools are in the trunk.
When George Pelicanos talks about what it was like growing up in D.C., he describes himself as a bit of a greaser. He once drove a jacked-up Camaro and liked to go to bars and drink whiskey. But he also worked as a dishwasher and sold women's shoes. It's no wonder Pelicanos can move so easily through the different worlds that make up D.C. He says he's liked getting to know two other cities, Baltimore when he wrote for The Wire, and now New Orleans writing for Tremé. But he says his novels will always take place in D.C. His life's work is right here. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You can delve into the D.C. that George Pelicanos writes about with photographs and readings at NPR.org. Our series Crime in the City resumes on Thursday with a cop's eye view of hard-boiled Seattle. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Rosa Parks has inspired generations with her determination to fight an unjust system. In that spirit, author Susan Choi recommends three books that feature characters whose wills are tested, and they not only survive, but come out stronger.
All the survival challenges I've been faced with so far in my life were about on the level of the time I locked myself in my basement without a cell phone. I'm not a danger seeker, and I've always been a little suspicious of people who are. But those forced to struggle for their very survival due to the cruelty of others, or freaks of the weather, or strange twists of fate, earn my unqualified awe. Here are three electrifying stories of very young people surviving very bad things. Peter Rock's My Abandonment takes its inspiration from the true story of a young girl discovered living with her father in a makeshift hidden shelter in Portland, Oregon's Forest Park. In Rock's novel, 13-year-old Caroline fully accepts her father's dictum that they live in isolation and hiding, trusting no one but each other. Yet the crystalline ingenuousness of Caroline's voice increasingly reveals father as a charismatic but paranoid megalomaniac. Rock enters so fully into the lonely and impoverished existence of Caroline and father that we have to remind ourselves that My Abandonment isn't a lost girl's journal, but a work of fiction, an astonishing imagining of unimaginable lives. Like My Abandonment, Francisco Goldman's The Ordinary Seaman also makes riveting fiction of miserable fact. In this case, the abuse of a group of Central American sailors held captive in Brooklyn. The title character is Esteban, a 19-year-old veteran of the war in Nicaragua. Devastated by combat and the death of a girl soldier he'd loved, Esteban thinks he has nothing to lose. But when he travels to Brooklyn to take a job as a sailor aboard a ship called the Eurus, he finds he was wrong. The Eurus is a wreck, and its crew, all fellow penniless Central Americans, are now virtually prisoners, charged with the impossible task of repairing the ship. Nearly as marooned as they'd be on a desert island, the would-be sailors feast their eyes on the lights of Manhattan while freezing and starving, until at last Esteban strikes out to seek help. His eventual triumph, so hard won, is a triumph for us all. One can only hope that Marianne Wiggins's John Dollar isn't based on a true story. John Dollar follows a group of little girls, some barely older than toddlers, who, after being shipwrecked on a wild remote island, are driven to commit shocking acts to survive. That Marianne Wiggins herself described the book as a kind of female Lord of the Flies should give the reader fair warning of what lies ahead. But rest assured, despite the fact that Wiggins cites her own antecedents, John Dollar is an absolute original, a book you'll find impossible to put down, even if, on some pages, you'll want to. All three of these books are in part, and very much by design, harrowing. But all three are that much more transforming of us as readers, especially if the worst thing that we've ever encountered was getting locked in the basement.
Three book recommendations from Susan Choi. She's the author of A Person of Interest.
Let's end this hour with another installment of Crime in the City. That's our summer series where crime novelists take us around the hard-boiled neighborhoods where their stories are set. This morning, NPR's Martin Casti introduces us to an author who knows well what was once one of the tougher neighborhoods of Seattle.
The rain, the seaport, the gloomy Scandinavians. Seattle would seem the ideal setting for crime novels. But if it's noir you're after, you should start your search at the Seattle Mystery Bookshop.
Considering the number of serial killers in the Great Northwest, I don't know if there is a specific noir part of Seattle, but this would be a good one.
J.B. Dickey is talking about Seattle's downtown. His bookstore is just a few steps from the waterfront and the original Skid Road. The thing is, although there are still plenty of guys drinking out of paper bags here, downtown Seattle just isn't as noir as it used to be. To get a sense of what it once was, Dickey recommends First Avenue, a thriller by writer Loewen Claussen.
It goes back to the days when it was a seedier strip, when it was more about sailors on leave and tattoo joints and strip joints and the donut shop.
The donut shop. It doesn't sound seedy until you read the book.
An old man came through the door. He bought a cup of coffee at the counter, but his hand shook most of the coffee out of the plastic cup before he reached a table. A woman pushed a shopping cart heaped with bags and boxes. Her dull eyes stared straight ahead, but at nothing. She took her two donuts outside and ate them beside her cart.
In the book First Avenue, the donut shop is a front for a criminal enterprise run by a creepy foreigner. In real life, well, that's pretty much what it was.
It's right there. It's now a T-shirt company.
Here's the author, Loewen Claussen. 30 years ago, he was a policeman in downtown Seattle, and he had firsthand knowledge of the donut shop.
The owner of the donut shop, his name was Gunther. He had these kids all working for him, and they would steal and burglarize in the area, and then he would fence the stuff out of it. And sometimes he participated in the burglaries, too.
Clausen is a fit, easygoing guy with a gray buzz cut. It's not hard to believe he's a former cop. Emphasis on former. Back then, his beat was Pike Place Market. These days, the market is the most touristy part of Seattle. It's that place where everybody shoots the home videos of the guys throwing the fish. But in the late 70s, Clausen says, things here were a bit dicier.
They may not have the pin maps of crimes anymore. I don't know. This is probably all computerized. But we used to have the pin maps on the wall. And in this area, for the month, there wasn't room, you know, for all the pins to go in.
Clausen takes a seat in the Athenian. It's one of those diners in the market where you're paying for the view, not the food. A bank of fog is rolling in across the sound, a touch of atmosphere for an otherwise blandly beautiful summer day. It wasn't far from here, he says, where, as a young cop, he started writing his book.
I found that this when I started working in the 4 a.m. shift, there would always be a quiet hour or so before things really happened, and I had a friend who had a little restaurant here just a few doors away from this, ran the restaurant by himself, just a little corner space.
And every morning, Clausen stopped in for a cup of coffee and sat down in a booth to write. Soon after that, he left the police, dedicating himself to writing a book about growing up. But publishers were more interested in his police experience. So he gave them First Avenue, then Second Watch, and finally, Third and Forever. To keep himself interested, he wrote about women police officers, Catherine Murphy and later Grace Stevens.
Toward the end of my time on the police department was the first time that women officers were hired to work the streets. And much against my will, I was assigned to work with a new woman officer.
Against his will, he says, because he doubted women had the physical presence for the job. But he changed his mind.
They didn't rely upon, necessarily upon strength or force. They relied upon the position, their job, and the sort of the moral authority. And that really impressed me.
In Clausen's books, female police officers find themselves sometimes overcompensating for their supposed weakness. In First Avenue, after a confrontation with a knife-wielding drunk, Officer Catherine Murphy is surprised by her own violent instincts.
She remembered how she felt as she had told him to drop the knife. Hate. Was it really hate? She remembered the look on his face, the sound of the knife as it hit the floor, her lack of relief that he had complied.
I felt like he portrayed those female officers very well.
Donna Burgess was Clausen's squad car partner. She now lives on Whidbey Island, near Seattle, and is still Clausen's friend. She says his books capture the early female cops' urge to prove themselves.
I know I was way more gung-ho, naive, ready to go fight crime. And he was always trying to hold me back.
Lowen Clausen was an accidental police officer, an English major who needed a job, and he was also an accidental crime writer. These days, he's writing the more personal books that he'd planned back when he was walking the beat. But on his way out of Pike Place Market, he pauses outside a darkened Chinese restaurant.
So this is the restaurant right here, and this was called Alex's Restaurant.
He peers through the window to find the spot where the young beat cop used to sit and take notes about the local characters.
The street people, the vendors, the merchants, all kind of put together here in one place. And so I started writing about this because I wanted to remember it.
Clausen admits he misses it, but he doesn't second-guess his decision to leave the police 30 years ago. After all, that world is now mostly gone. His friend with the restaurant has died, the tourists outnumber the street people, and Seattle's notorious donut shop now sells T-shirts. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Read passages from Lowen Clausen's Mysteries at NPR.org. Tomorrow, A Private Eye takes readers through Chicago, from the gritty to the Gold Coast, as our series Crime in the City continues on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Pop stars from Lady Gaga to Madonna to U2 have cited David Bowie as a main influence, a genius even. But in a new biography about the life of one of pop music's most innovative stars, Paul Trinka writes about how David Bowie carefully cultivated that image. In fact, Bowie never believed he had much talent at all. Trinka spent years interviewing hundreds of people who have known David Bowie. The story of his life begins in the hardscrabble London neighborhood of Brixton, a part of the city that was still in ruins after the end of the Second World War.
He's got a favorite work called Dystopian, and from the today's perspective, it's kind of quite science fiction, his upbringing. So you've got a lot of showbiz, you've got vaudeville entertainers who used to live there, but at the same time, you've got these little rows of Victorian houses and just raised fields, and that's where the kids used to play. So it was a very specific upbringing in time and space.
He was in a series of sort of pop bands and almost boy bands, really from the age of 15 onward. He sort of breaks out in 1969. He's only 22 years old, and he has this song, Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
He claimed that it was supposedly inspired by the actual Apollo 11 moon landing. Is that true?
The song was really inspired more than anything by going to see Kubrick's movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. And also, it was typical of many elements of his career. It was a mix of kind of inspiration and marketing, because he came across this song and then realized straight on that with the moonshot coming up, that it represented a terrific marketing opportunity. And he used it to basically speed up and to market the single in the hope that that would be his breakthrough.
2 years later, he puts out another record that, again, is regarded as a seminal Bowie work, Hunky Dory. Lyrically, it's impossible to believe that this was written by a man just 24 years old.
I'm closer to the golden dawn, immersed in Crowley's uniform of imagery. I'm living in a silent film, portraying Himmler's sacred realm of dream reality.
This album and this song is filled with references to Aleister Crowley and Nietzsche and German fascism and all these very complex ideas. Where was he getting them from? Because he finished high school, but David Bowie was not an educated man. I mean, at this point, he was writing about some pretty big ideas.
He always engaged with the big ideas. It has to be said that early on, he was probably more adept at dropping names than of developing very deep philosophies. Mm. So in many respects, a lot of what we hear on Hunky Dory is quite conventional. And it's a real testament to how human beings can transform themselves. You know, as a child, there's a beat boom musician, he wasn't a particularly good musician. He was a fairly dreadful songwriter early on. And then by having this self-belief and this way of converting admirers to his cause, in the end, he'd actually become the genius that he'd convinced people he already was. He wasn't like Elvis, who just seemed to pop out of the womb that way. So I do believe this story is a great one of transcending the limitations with which you're born.
I'm speaking with Paul Trinka. He's the author of a new biography of David Bowie, and it's called Starman. Paul, he kind of adopts this persona, this kind of androgynous persona, and it becomes his shtick. I mean, it becomes part of who he wants to be, getting to the point where he basically proclaims that he's gay.
Yes, he basically tells Melody Maker, I'm gay, and I always have been, even when I was David Jones.
And at that point, he was married, we should say. He had married Angela
Barnett. Absolutely. And so again, you know, what we're seeing here is somebody with a very sophisticated understanding of the power of press. He knew exactly the power of those words. He was also pretty sincere. And in some ways, he was championing a lifestyle. So it operated on every level. It fitted in with the music. It was linked to an amazing aesthetic. He was dressed like somebody from Mars. He had these jumpsuits that he'd commissioned from a gay fellow who lived in the house with him. He'd cut his hair short, just signalling that the 60s are over and something new is about to start.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Weird and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars.
David Bowie's character, Ziggy Stardust, this persona he adopts, who was Ziggy Stardust? Where did he come from?
Ziggy was this magnificent creation. He combined the 50s and Eddie Cochran. He was heavily influenced by Iggy Pop, Iggy, Ziggy. So he was a kind of assemblage, and via this persona, Ziggy, he could become this lost, flamboyant hero.
Making love with his ego. Ziggy is sucked up into his mind.
What's amazing to me, Paul, about David Bowie is this period, the 1969 to 1982, it's such a fruitful period. He produces so many incredible pieces of music. And for a lot of that time, he's strung out. I mean, he is a cocaine addict.
The period of serious cocaine addiction, really, it centers on the album Station to Station.
Well, which some critics consider his greatest.
Well, it was certainly his most intense album. And you can see that in many ways the cocaine improves to his work. So the kind of damage he did to his brain and the extreme experiences were a big part of his art.
He spent some time during the late 70s in Berlin. That is where he teams up with Brian Eno and Iggy Pop. And, of course, the Berlin Trilogy comes out of this period. But Heroes is the song that becomes his best-known song from that period.
By Heroes, he could express himself incredibly simply. He was actually improvising the lyrics, using a technique he'd seen his friend Iggy, or Jimmy as he called him, use, where he'd just write the words or improvise them and then sing them just a few seconds later. So when those words, you know, ring out across a huge recording studio in Hansa, just near the Berlin Wall, that's the first time they've actually filtered into his brain, and there's a wonderful freshness there.
Six years after Heroes, Bowie releases Let's Dance. This is a song that a lot of Bowie fans did not like. A lot of critics just thought it was a one-off thing. But this is the only song David Bowie ever sang that reached number one, both in the U.S. and in Britain.
Let's Dance gets a lot of guilt by association because the music that came after it was really quite derivative and uninspired. But Let's Dance as an album even stands up today because sonically it's so unique. It's very minimal. There's a fantastic beat to it.
Basically, for the last 15 years of his life, he hasn't produced any really notable music. Do you think that will affect the way people remember him?
That there was a certain drop in quality over a certain period, but at the same time, in terms of how he's refashioned the sound of today, his impact's bigger than most other people. I would say it's probably bigger than Hendrix. It's bigger than rock bands like Led Zeppelin, because he's had an incredible influence on every level in terms of what we demand of our artists, that they do change, they progress from album to album. And certainly any time you listen to music that's got synthesizers and a funky beat, when you listen to Blur or Arcade Fire or Mercury Rev, there's an entire aesthetic that he's invented. So I think as time goes on, his contribution will be more and more valued.
I know Bowie fans will be disappointed that we've just scratched the surface, but what a fascinating book. That's Paul Trinka. He's author of the new biography, David Bowie, Starman. He joined us from London. Paul Trinka, thank you very much.
Thank you, Guy. Absolute pleasure.
Our book today is about a mystery that's never been solved, the case of explorer Everett Ruiz. Ruiz could have been one of this country's greatest wilderness writers, a poet and author on a par with John Muir or Edward Abbey. But we'll never know for sure because Ruiz disappeared without a trace in November 1934. He was only 20 years old when he led his two burros out of the remote southern Utah town of Escalante down a desolate trail towards the Colorado River and was never seen again.
Even though he was only 20 years old when he vanished, he had already produced an amazingly precocious body of writing and artwork. He did watercolors and block print engravings, which are quite accomplished for a teenager. And he wrote passionate poems, diaries, and letters to his parents and friends.
That's David Roberts. He's the author of a new book called Finding Everett Ruiz, The Life and Unsolved Disappearance of a Legendary Wilderness Explorer. Now, most people had never heard of Ruiz until author John Krakauer devoted a chapter to him in his book Into the Wild. That book's about Christopher McCandless, another young explorer who met a similar fate. In the case of Everett Ruiz, David Roberts says his parents wanted their youngest son to achieve fame after his death, so they kept all of his artwork, diaries, and letters.
Once they were resigned to the idea that he might never be found, and in fact that we might never know what happened to him, they were determined to guarantee him some kind of posthumous fame.
He wrote in his letters of this almost mystical love of nature, his desire for solitude, and also his struggle with solitude when he was out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is the 1930s, southern Utah at that time. This was frontier country.
It was beyond frontier. It was real wilderness. I argue that as precocious and interesting as the writing and the artwork is, the greatest achievement was the journeys themselves, which in 1931, when he was 17 years old, he did a 10-month nonstop crisscrossing of the Southwest when in 1931 it was really, except for the Navajo presence on the reservation, was pretty much total wilderness. And he's doing most of this solo with a couple of pack animals. Extraordinary. I mean, people don't do that today, let alone back in the 30s.
He was an artist, and you write about how he would go to the doorsteps of famous artists that he admired, Ansel Adams, Dorothea Lange, and just basically become friends with them.
Yes, he's an odd combination of a very shy kid and a very pushy, gregarious kid. At the age 16, he just goes up in Carmel, California, and knocks on Edward Weston's door and introduces himself. Well, most famous photographers would have kicked him out. Instead, Weston was somehow taken with this kid and told him he could sleep in the garage and hike around with his sons, Weston's sons. Same way he met Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams. But on the other hand, he never really found the right partner to travel with. He finally says that the only two things that he cares about are solitude and beauty. And it's the beauty that's the ultimate driving force. He was, some argue, the very first person to celebrate the beauty of the American Southwest strictly for its own sake.
One of the poems that he became best known for, of course, posthumously, is a poem called Wilderness Song, and you publish it in your book. Can you just read a bit of that poem for us?
I'll read the last stanza. It's kind of an apologia for what he was doing. And it's a little bit intense, but it's a good, almost epitaph. Quote, "Say that I starved, that I was lost and weary, that I was burned and blinded by the desert sun, footsore, thirsty, sick with strange diseases, lonely and wet and cold, but that I kept my dream."
Yeah. And, of course, it was these kinds of poems that kind of added to his legend. Tell me about what happened in 1934. He tells his family, I'm going to go out for a long stretch of time, and I want to explore this area in southern Utah.
1934 was the last of his five voyages, was the most ambitious and the one in which he plunged deepest into the wilderness. Every other year, he'd sort of come home. By November, he was always back in L.A. This time in November, he's decided to just keep going. So he heads down to southwestern Utah, to the really remote town of Escalante, a Mormon town then very seldom passed through by strangers. And he spends a few days in town, and what's extraordinary when I did research there is how many of the old-timers remembered those 6 or 7 or 8 days that Everett had spent there in November 34. And then, with they all thought way too little food and way too little camping gear, he just heads out down the Hole in the Rock Trail, which is really desolate, empty, meets a couple of sheep herders, spends 2 nights with them, asks directions for side canyons, goes into Davis Gulch, and is never seen again, alive or dead.
The story of Everett Ruiz really came back in 2008. You received a phone call from a friend of yours, a wilderness guide, who said, we may have found his remains. What did you think when you heard that?
I thought at first there's no way it's possible. But more and more my friend Vaughn said, you got to come out here and look at it.
It turns out that a friend of his, the grandson of a Navajo Indian, who apparently witnessed Everett Ruiz's murder in 1934, had buried the body. That was the story that was told. So you were thinking at the time, my God, we found him. We got him.
I was skeptical until the DNA came back with a perfect match first time through. And we announced it to the world a little bit prematurely, perhaps.
Prematurely because subsequent tests showed that indeed it was not Everett Ruiz.
Exactly.
It must have been quite devastating for you after having that false positive.
It was truly devastating, not just to me, but to everybody involved, some 8 or 10 people. And beyond devastating, we felt a deep sense of shame because it turned out that we had dug up a Native American and not Everett. And that's a serious desecration. And we keep wondering if our zeal to solve the mystery overcame our sense of prudence and caution.
His last letter to his brother Waldo, it was written in November 1934. It almost seems prophetic. Can you read a bit of that letter that he wrote to his brother?
Yes, it's one of the last two letters that he wrote to anyone that have survived. He also wrote his parents. He ends the letter, "As to when I shall visit civilization, it will not be soon, I think. I have not tired of the wilderness. Rather, I enjoy its beauty and the vagrant life I lead more keenly all the time. I prefer the saddle to the streetcar and the star-sprinkled sky to a roof, the obscure and difficult trail leading into the unknown to any paved highway, and the deep peace of the wild to the discontent bred by cities."
Some of the last recorded words of Everett Ruiz, read by David Roberts. He's the author of Finding Everett Ruiz, The Life and Unsolved Disappearance of a Legendary Wilderness Explorer. David Roberts, thanks so much.
Thank you. This is fun.